Hello. It's really an honor to speak here tonight for the Shloshim of Rav Kuperman. I look around and I see so many students who are touched directly and indirectly by him. Rav Kuperman was a pioneer in women's education, period. I remember his classes in Michlala, then in Tasham, 1979-1980. When I attended Machal, he was the dean of the school and very busy in expanding the offerings for the Israeli students. It was one of the first years of the new campus down the mountain, and Machal was really expanding that year as well. The Breshit class with Rav Kuperman was chova for all the Machal students, so it was a huge class that year, but it was a highlight for me. It was Rav Kuperman's link to Benot Machal. In class, he was a man on a mission. He wanted to inculcate respect and admiration for the Avot and the Mesorah, Midrash and Parshanim, Emunat Chachamim. He wanted the students to care deeply about their religious lives and learning, their halacha and shmirat ha-mitzvot. He wanted them to engage the text and read carefully. He had a very clear hashkafah of the world and Tanakh, and he wanted to impart it to his students. He wanted to impart a very specific worldview regarding contemporary religious authority, about which we respectfully sparred every so often inside and outside of class. He was such a charming Irishman. He had a twinkle in his eye, and he was eager to listen, but also to always make a comment. Everything was a lesson, and he had a pithy saying to go along with it. For me, Michlala was not transformative in the usual sense, because I already loved learning and wanted to dedicate my life to it, but it was a very important step of intensive learning and exposure to a wide array of Torah and learning hashkafot. My year in Michlala impacted my life in so many different ways. Subsequently, when I went to Israel, I would try to meet with him, with Rav Kuperman, and over the years we met many times and spoke about many issues, especially family and learning. We also always discussed Shitat Rashi, Parshanut, trends in teaching, and the issues of contemporary society. He was always very proud of his Michlala graduates. He really saw them as family. My year in Michlala was an important personal experience, and so far, three of my daughters also went to Michlala, and all took his classes, especially that special Meshech Chochma Chug in his home all the way up in Beit Vagan. By that time, he didn't have administrative duties and had more time for his students. I would always sit in on his classes when I came to visit, so I really had many opportunities to hear Rav Kuperman over the years. He always reminded me a little of my father. Both of them were consummate pedagogues and actually both knew each other very, very well, because in that time in Israel, in the 50s, everybody really knew each other in the area of education. One of my husband's cousins, Dr. Ruti Ben-Meir, went to the seminar Mizrahi Lemorot, where she also studied with Nechama Leibovitz. This was a short program spanning several months, and if you wanted to continue your studies, your choice was to go to Bar-Ilan University or start teaching right away. Bar-Ilan University was established in 1955, which originally was a religious Mizrahi university and had a midrashah for women. But if you did not want to go to a co-ed university and be in a co-ed environment, university was not an option for you. So what did you do? Rav Kuperman had an idea. He launched a new concept in women's Torah education in 1964 called Michlala. Dr. Dvorah Rosenwasser says that her father, Rav Kuperman, made up this word, with this word. Now it is used for colleges everywhere in Israel. He wanted it to be more than a seminary that had potential to give college degrees. His vision to establish an institute of in-depth Torah studies exclusively for women that would be founded on the principles of Ahavat HaTorah, Torah Mishamayim, and Emunat Chachamim. An institution, in his words, Torah im Derech Eretz. At first, they were granting teaching certificates, and his original goal was to develop excellent, knowledgeable teachers for the Israeli school system. And in 1978, they were granting academic degrees. He coined the phrase, HaTohar Shebatohar, the purity of the degree. He loved wordplay. He really believed that you can achieve both high Torah and high academic achievements while maintaining rigorous, excellent religious values and not compromise one iota. What inspired me to start Michlala, said Rav Kuperman, was my experience while teaching in a more modern religious teacher's college. A student in the class said to me, "Mora, do you know that we were taught that we don't have to listen to Chazal and we may differ with Chazal anytime we want?" That day, said Rav Kuperman, I resigned. I had thought about resigning before that, But I was enjoying my career. I was principal of Boys Town, where I didn't have to deal with administrative duties. I was studying in the Chevron Yeshiva Kollel in the morning, had chavrutot in the afternoon. But I felt that something had to be done for women's education. These are quotes from the Jewish Action interview with Rav Kupperman with Tovi Klein Greenwald in spring 2014. There was very strong opposition from the right and from the left for his concept and the actual school once it was established. But Rav Kupperman persevered and stood his ground. Rav Kupperman had an idyllic vision that all streams of frum religious ideologies could be together in one institution as long as the ironclad belief of the principles Avat HaTorah, Emunat Chachamim, and Yirat Shamayim were shared. In reality, this was and is a difficult goal in Israel or anywhere, but that was always his goal. Michlala, Jerusalem College for Women, opened its doors with 23 or 18 students, depend whose version you listen to, and our cousin Ruti Ben Meir was in the first class. Subsequently, she was the head of the Midrasha in Bar Ilan, and her daughter, Hadassah, also obviously our cousin, is now the head of all education, all public education in Israel. So we have many families, right, connections, right, with Michlala and future academic achievement. Dvorah Rosenwasser, Rav Kupperman's daughter, says that Rav Kupperman always said that he established it for her because he was worried where she would attend college. He was also an innovator in programs for study in Israel. Machon Gold was established before by the World Zionist Organization as a program to encourage women to come study in Israel, and that was established in 1958. But Rav Kupperman saw that and wanted to establish another program in Michlala for women to come and study in depth and be steeped in Torah values and be more connected with Israeli students. That was the original goal. In my time already, the program was completely separate from the Israelis, but we dormed with Israelis. Now the dorm rooms are even separate as well, but still, being in Israel, of course, is a very special experience in Michlala because we are interacting with the other students. He met with a handful of educators, including my father, Rabbi David Eliach, who was the principal of Yeshiva Flatbush High School and a pioneer in establishing post-high school Israel programs, to decide if there is a need for the Michlala Machal program. And he met with other principals, and they decided absolutely. And Rav Kupperman established Machal in 1969, and it was a model for many other programs. Rav Kupperman was born in Dublin to parents who imbued him with a love for Chesed, Torah, and Eretz Yisrael. His father died when he was only 11, but all six children in the family remained frum, which at that time was a huge achievement. He attended Dublin University and was involved in the activities of religious youth movements. He studied under Eliyahu Dessler at the Gateshead Yeshiva. Rav Kupperman quoted Michtav Me'Eliyahu many times in class, and that was one of his favorite go-to Musar books. And one of my friends bought it for me for my birthday in our year in Michlala together. He later made Aliyah and studied under Rabbi Yecheskel Sarna at the Chevron Yeshiva. He earned smicha from Rabbi Sarna and from Rabbi Herzog, the then chief rabbi of the State of Israel. In 1952, he married his wife Sipora. In my time, she was still the rabbanit. And he returned to Dublin University, where he received a master's degree in Semitic languages and became the first Jew to be awarded the prestigious gold medal for academic achievement, recommended by the same professors under whom he studied biblical criticism and with whom he vehemently disagreed and argued all the time. He moved to the U.S. and earned a second master's degree in education from the University of Chicago. The Coopermans returned to Eretz Yisrael in 1956. He taught all those years in teacher seminaries, on the radio, and was the principal of Boys Town, as we said earlier, and in 1964 really established Michlala. In 1975, he received a doctorate from Hebrew Theological College of Skokie, the Yeshiva, for all of those who are Chicago aficionados, for his supra commentary to the Meshech Chochmah, right? Rav Kupperman wrote a commentary to the Meshech Chochmah, and that in turn set the stage for Michlala to be fully accredited since the dean had a doctorate. Rav Kupperman liked to say that Michlala was a chiddush, offering Torah study at such a high level for women, to educate mechanchot, and also encouraging women to build Torah homes. Rav Kupperman saw this as his Kiddush Hashem. He raised a wonderful family, imbued in Torah, and many of whom are educators in Michlala today. He leaves a strong written legacy, several monographs, his commentary on Rav Meir Simcha's Meshech Chochmah, and one on Svorno. He also wrote Mikra Kipshuto, What is Pshat?, a work that in his eyes was very important in combating what he saw as the unrestrained interpretations proliferating in the name of Pshat, He asked that on his kever it should say, Ve'et Yehuda shalach lefanav lehorot. Yehuda was sent forward to teach. This refers to Yaakov sending Yehuda ahead to Goshen in Mitzrayim to set up the Batei Midrash. Just like Yehuda Cooperman, right? He was a man with a mission. He was a man of vision and implementation who saw that the institutions during his time were not fulfilling an important mission in women's education and spiritual development. He was able to realize that dream and shepherd and expand it for several decades, making it a major learning institution. There are only a handful of people in every generation who have that kind of impact. The Jewish community will miss him very much, but his legacy lives on. Yehi Zichro Baruch.
I'm in a very lucky spot, actually, because Professor Rosenzweig took half of my speech, and it was too long, so now it's perfect. That's actually perfect. I was torn between wanting to speak about Rav Cooperman as a person and the institution that he built and the what the institution meant to me and to the rest of us, and also wanting to say something about his Torah, to actually give over what was important to him. And I know that what he would have cared more if somebody would have asked him, what do you want us to say at your shloshim? He would have said, just learn what I taught. So I will say a couple of words, since Professor Rosenzweig did such a wonderful job of telling us what the institution did, and then I will talk about his written output. I'm not going to say a Dvar Torah, but I'm going to explain to you what he did in his writing. Look at his writing career and what he did, and then you can learn it and understand, you know, if you want to stay afterwards for the optional learning, you'll understand what that sefer means. The institution that he built, it's clear that he was a pioneer, as Professor Rosenzweig said. He did something different for the Israelis than he did for the Americans. And I think that that's where we sort of get caught. He believed that you could have a good secular education and a good Torah education, but he loved Torah more. Despite all the degrees that he had, all the secular degrees, he once told me, he said, I hope I forgot all of that already. And that was the truth. He really, even though he had all the degrees and they helped him, they did help him, but he was happy if he would have forgotten what he had learned. He cared about teaching. You could see the excitement on his face. He would talk about some Bogeret Mechlala who was living up in Kiryat Shmona with 8 kids and not 3 pennies to scrape together, but was teaching. That was his pride and joy. That was what he cared about. So how did he do it? What Professor Rosenzweig said, that he said they mentioned on the website, they had an Azkara for Rav Cooperman when they got up from Shiva. And Dr. Rosenwasser said, when she said about what he wanted to put on his matseva, that he wanted they should write, Vet Yehuda shalach lefanav lehorot, she said he wasn't afraid of death. And that he faced death, he also wasn't afraid in life. He put himself into a very tricky place. And now we take it for granted that women can learn, but he was in a very tricky place. He put himself there, and he knew how to navigate it. He had very high standards. They used to have these Bekiut tests. A friend of mine who did 4 years in the Israeli program tells me, she said, I hated every minute of it. She said, we had those ridiculous Bekiut tests. She says, we had to study. I mean, the lists went on and on because we got copies of them. We got copies of the lists of what they had to study. She said, I hated every minute of it. But today, she is one of the best teachers that I know. She says, now I appreciate what he did for us. And she said, and to think that we didn't even get a BA. All we got was a B.Ed. right? Because at that time they weren't giving out real degrees. There were people who said, if you're going to teach the girls something, they won't be able to get married. And he said, let the boys rise to the occasion. He didn't, he was not afraid. He said, that's not a reason not to do it. He was ambitious. If you think that this man who was running an institution had a large family, he had a shiur every Shabbat afternoon. He had, for years, this was going on for decades, because I know people who went, he had shiurim in the community. Every Shabbos afternoon they were studying, and everything was on a high level, and everything he prepared. He was always prepared. I don't think that I ever, there was one time in the year when he came to class and he said, today I'm not going to teach. So you could just ask questions or whatever. And I was so disappointed. I was like, what do you mean? Like, I came to learn. Like, you can't do that. But he really, there was a constant, it was a very high standard, and he was ambitious. He didn't think small. He thought in terms of giving a shiur in the community every day and running a school and writing books. He cared about every student. Tova Kfiat, who was there 2 years ago, now the man was 84. She says that he learned with them. They had a three-person chavrusa with Rav Kuperman. Now, what's a man who's running this huge institution? People are calling him all the time. But he cared about every student. He knew that Torah was not just about the learning. It wasn't just intellectual. He expected it to affect you. He expected you to think about who you were. He knew it was about self-definition. I remember when I was teaching in Bruria, there was a student, this goes back at least 20 years, more. This was like in 1990. This goes back 25 years. There was a student in Bruria who wanted, her idea was she was going to go to Bravender's, and then she was going to go to Mechloa to listen to some shiurim there. She wanted to have the best of both worlds. And I didn't see the problem with it. I didn't see what the big deal was. So I called him to intercede on her behalf. So he gets on the phone, and he says to me, if you're calling about so-and-so, the answer is no. What do you mean? He had a backbone. He was a leader with a backbone. This we do, this we don't do. And if I was asking him to do something that didn't fit with the way he wanted to run the institution, then there was nothing to talk about. I can tell you that my year in Mechlala, I just like Professor Rosenzweig, I came with a love of learning. I had been learning on my own. I loved learning, and I knew that I wanted to continue doing it. But the year did have a profound impact on me in that it showed me that if I didn't fulfill that dream, see, when I came in, I had that dream, but I thought that it was like some mishigas that I had, that he showed me that if I didn't fulfill it, and if I didn't make something out of myself in learning, then I would be a failure. It wasn't just that I have this bug in my head. It was that, of course, that's what you have to do. He thought that learning was one of the most important, if not the most important, meaningful way for a woman to express herself, and he expected women to do it. And in that way, that was the most profound idea of the year. Now, if you take a look at his books, I spread around some, and I don't want to take away Dr. Rabinovich's speech, but I spread around some of his, let's just take a look at the books. Forget about the articles. I went on Rambi. He's got 36 articles. If you take a look at the books, there are two types of writing. One is actual material, okay? So there are the chovrot, right, which Dr. Rabinovich is going to share with you. They're actual material. So he started putting these together 2 years before he opened the Mechlala. The first one is 1962. He lays out Chazal and Pirushim, and he explains them. He's organizing the sources. He walks you through the interesting questions on the topic so you can learn it systematically. He's helping you learn. The underlying material is not new. His explanations are new. It's meant for elementary and high school teachers, but he also got to a wider audience. Now, what do you see in the writing as it develops? He keeps improving. If you look at the early writings, he writes what he's planning, and then he keeps changing his methodology, and he keeps explaining to you how he's changing the methodology. And he keeps saying, well, he says, well, we see that we've run into this kind of problem with this methodology, so this is how we're going to change it. He's constantly improving and he's constantly growing. He struggles with how to meet the needs of his audience. He's in constant intellectual conversation with the people around him. He keeps saying, please write me your suggestions, write me your comments, write me your questions and I'll answer you. What do you mean write me your questions and I'll answer you? You have nothing better to do? Write me your questions and I'll answer you. That's what he wanted. He's clear, he's systematic. I would think that his Meshech Chochma falls into this category, because basically what is his Pirush on the Meshech Chochma? It's Mekorot. I know two people who use it constantly who swear by his Pirush on the Meshech Chochma, but it's not, it's basically helping you learn the Meshech Chochma, which is a very abstruse book. Just to show you how collaborative Rav Kuperman was, at least it's got to be 25 or 26 years ago, he sent me, before he put out the Sforno, he sent me a perek from the Sforno and asked me for some comments. Now, I was a teeny bopper then. I mean, I was a little schnook. What was I? I mean, why? He didn't do it for me. He didn't do it to teach me the importance of my opinions, because you could think, well, maybe he did it for... He honestly wanted to know what would people think of his writing. He was collaborative. He wanted to know what people would say. And then he has another category of writing, which is the methodological writing, what you're holding there, the Pirkei Mavo, Lemeshe Chochma, Lipshuto Shel Mikra, the book Lipshuto Shel Mikra. He has an intro to Ktava Kabbalah. He's got a work on the Ravid HaZahav. All of these are methodological writings, trying to explain to you how is the methodology of so-and-so different from the methodology of so-and-so. The work, his magnum opus, Lipshuto Shel Mikra, Al Mikomo Shel Hapshuto Shel Mikra, B'Shleimut HaTorah U'B'Kedushata, which was published in 2001, is also methodological. It's basically a reworking and a reorganization of the materials that he had before. Now, the Sefer that came out in 2013, which is going to be presented for learning after in the optional learning, what he did there is that he says that he realized that some of his methodological writings may be too up in the air for regular people. And therefore, he's going to try to bring the methodological writings into a work on Parshat Shavua. So he has organized. It's really a combination of both styles of writing. On the one hand, he's teaching you real material, but at the same time, he's giving you, working in the methodology. I think we should end by not being morose. Rav Kuperman had a tremendous sense of humor. A friend of mine used to write on the top of the notebook page, used to write down all the jokes that he, and she had a joke on every page, okay? So I don't think we should be morose. I think the purpose of an Azkara is to honor and respect the person whose life we're commemorating, but also for us to learn from it and apply from it to our own lives. We're not going to be him, but the same way that whatever aspects of him we appreciated, we can take from those and apply to our own lives.
What I'm finding fascinating about this evening, we were each asked to speak a little bit about Rav Kuperman, and each one of us has taken a different derech, a different way of approaching the evening. By coincidence, we hadn't talked about this beforehand. So We all intuited well. What I'd like to do with you tonight is to share a little bit more personally what going to Michlala meant to me. I think in this last month it's put me very reflective. The fact that I'm standing here teaching at Stern College, running a Jewish ed program, can most probably be traced back to my decision to attend Michlala. So I'd like to invite you to join on this journey. I was 16 at the time when I actually walked into Michlala. I was a senior in high school. My birthday's in November. So just imagine a 16-year-old coming, and you'll see what I'm doing with it. It was October 1982, Tavshin Mem Gimel. Yom Tov was early that year, so Michlala wasn't starting till October, and I had begged my parents to allow me to expand my year by going for the Yom Tovim as well. So after the Chag, my cousin drove me to Michlala, and I stood there with my luggage, and I thought, I don't think I'm in Kansas anymore. Okay, really Detroit, but accept the quote. Everything about Michlala was new and different. From the building, my high school was one corridor of a two-corridor building. Here, the campus, even in 1982, was multi-level building just for learning. The dorms, the pnimiyot, the chadar ochel, it was huge. The number of participants, I came from a class of seven girls. The entire high school, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th, numbered around 70. Here, I was to be part of the largest machal to date, over 100 girls. We were divided into four kvutzot, which meant that each kvutza had 25 girls or more. At home, I knew everybody in my class. I knew everybody in the school. Here, I knew my fellow girls from Detroit. There were about nine of us. Only a few of them were in my kvutza. But perhaps the biggest difference was in the range and caliber of the classes being offered, a tribute to Rav Cooperman's vision and confidence in women's learning. The classes were challenging. The classes were engaging. The classes were exhilarating. Even with the seven girls in my class or the few that we were joined, we either went with a year above or below, we were on such different levels, we presented such a challenge for teachers to teach us that inevitably half of us were put on independent study. The idea of having classes that were on a high level, that were exciting, that we could all learn together was unbelievably a novel concept for me at the time. I remember the diversity of the girls who made up that machal. We came from England and France, from Italy and Switzerland. We came from Detroit and Chicago, from Los Angeles and Florida, from Silver Spring and Toronto, from Central to Prospect Park, from Ramaz to Flatbush. It took me a while to learn all the nuances of those places. I remember the diversity of the faculty. Teachers spoke Hebrew with Irish accents, with New York accents. Those from the Midwest didn't sound like an accent to me. But they were all sharing the same Ahavat HaTorah and Yirat Hashem. And I remember Rav Cooperman's class. They had combined two kfutzot, so we were over 50 girls. Remember, I'm used to classes of around 10? I learned to sit up front so I wouldn't see how many other people were there in the room behind me, and so I wouldn't be afraid to participate. He asked us to open up our chumashim to Bereshit Perak Aleph, and he started us on a journey. He introduced us to the first pasuk in Bereshit in a way that I had never seen it before. With it, Rashi, and with it, the Mefarshei Rashi. I had no idea they existed beforehand. I remember the twinkle in his eye and the passion that exuded from his personalities and the stories that came from his heart. I remember the rigor of the institution and the demands of the classes and the bikiyut that we had to study for. Baruch Hashem, the Madrichot held our hands the entire way. I remember the warmth of the people and the shira, the music that he and the Rabbanit introduced to us in the Zmirot of Shabbat. And what I'd like to do right now is to just read from one of the books that Dr. Gernhaus was talking about. Little did I know that I'd actually been introduced to one of these booklets in high school with the principal of my school at the time. There was a small chavruta of people who learned it. But I had no idea who this was until, somewhere in the middle of my machal year, I realized who it was. So one of the series that he has are on Keseh Shenitalma Mimeno Halacha, where Moshe didn't know the halacha. And this one is Parshat HaMekoshesh Eitzim. And I'm reading from the parak that talks about Yir'u Ki Hashem Natan Lachem Et HaShabbat. What is the purpose of the mitzvah of Shabbat? And he asks the following question. why did Hashem have to give Bnei Israel the mitzvah of Shabbat some two and a half weeks before Matan Torah? They were going to get the mitzvot, the Aserta Dibrot, od me'at, ototo. Shabbos was featured there prominently. Why introduce it beforehand? And, moreover, asks Rav Kupperman, why connect the mitzvah of Shabbat with the mitzvah of man? So in his introduction to the unit, he discusses how the essence of Shabbat is emunah b'Hashem, to the extent that one who's mechalel Hashem is considered oved avodah zarah, and on the other hand, one who is shomer Shabbat, me'id al emunato b'chidush ha'olam al yedei Hashem, testifies to his belief in creation and the renewal of the world all the time by Hashem. It's not enough, says Rav Kupperman, to have emunah. You also need bitachon. And bitachon is what we ultimately learned from the man. And as one of the sources, he quotes the Meshech Chochma, and I thought that that wouldn't be an appropriate one. It was also short enough to fit into the time element. But that to learn a few words of the Meshech Chochma that was so dear to Rav Kupperman's heart. And the Meshech Chochma talks about bitachon and the element of bitachon found in the man. Perush be'emet hayaba ze bitachon nifla v'nisayon tmidi. In the mitzvah of man, in the way that Bnei Israel had to receive man every day, there was tremendous bitachon, and there was also a constant test, a constant challenge. Ki hema ba'aretz lo zru'ah umunach man. They were in a land that had nothing else that was growing, and suddenly they would wake up and see the man, the holech li'ibud. But it wasn't as if they could go outside their tents all day long and get man. They only had it for a certain amount of time, and they couldn't leave it over to the next morning. Vehema loyal kitun rak hanitzrach le'otol yom. They were commanded only to gather that which they needed for each day. V'ze nisayon tmidi b'chol yom. And it was an ongoing challenge every day. And from this, Bnei Israel learned bitachon. When they had that foundation of bitachon, they were able then to build on it the emunah on Hashem, and from that stand be'amechad ke'amechad im levechad et har Torah. And I think, when I think of Rav Kupperman, of the ultimate message he shared with me and with so many others, were those two abiding concepts, the idea of bitachon b'Hashem and the idea of emunah b'Hashem. I am so grateful to what I was able to gain from him and from his institution, from his remarkable vision, and may his legacy continue. Yehi Zichro Baruch.
So about 2 weeks ago, Dr. Rosenwasser gave a share in memory of her father. And she said that hundreds of Machal girls, Michalah girls, came to her father's Shiva. And what was so remarkable was that there began to be a pattern in what people were saying. People were saying totally different things, but everyone started with the phrase, Haya li kesher miyuchad im Harav Kupperman. And she said it was starting to become even comical at a certain point. And she would look at her siblings and she would say, how? How did so many people have a kesher miyuchad with our father? He was an extremely busy man. He was doing so many things. He had a big family. He was running an institution. And when she was saying that, it resonated with me because I also felt that haya li kesher miyuchad im Harav Kupperman. And it started me thinking, how did he have such a kesher miyuchad with hundreds and hundreds of students? When I was in Machal, more recently than the other professors, Rav Kupperman taught three classes, Bereishis to the entire Machal, which was also a chova, I guess as it was back in the day, Rabbeinu Bechaye, Parashas HaShavua, which was part of the regular schedule, you could decide to take it or not, and Chug Meshech Chachma. And my mother, who had gone to Mechala herself, advised me to take every opportunity to learn from Rav Kupperman, so I signed up for all three. Last year, in March, I was in Eretz Yisrael for my brother's wedding. And while I was there, I decided that I must go visit Rav Kupperman. I'd been to Mechala to visit, But I really wanted to go visit Reb Kupperman. Time was running out. Purim day, I decided, okay, today's a good day. I didn't have access to so much technology at the time. So I said, okay, I'm going to go and try to find Reb Kupperman. I had one opportunity to call my sister, who was in Mechala at the time, to try to find out what was Reb Kupperman's address and what apartment number was it. But unfortunately, I was not able to get a hold of her. She was already on a bus to Gush. It was Purim on Friday. It was Shushan Purim because we were in Yerushalayim. But I was determined, and I said, I really want to go and try to find Reb Kupperman. So I went to Bayit Vegan. I started heading up, and I said, you know what, let me try to remember how the, you know, hills and staircases went when we used to go once a week to Reb Kupperman's house, because Chug Masha Chachma was in Reb Kupperman's house. So I tried to get myself in the mindset, even though I was in a car, so it was much more confusing. But we went up, and I knew it was on Rehov HaPiskah, and I came to a building that looked familiar, it felt familiar. I took my sister and one of my daughters along, my younger sister, who hadn't gone to Mechala yet. I figured Purim in Israel is the best time to accidentally knock on the wrong person's door. What's the worst that could happen? So I went into the building. I headed towards an apartment that I had a good feeling about. I knocked on the door and waited a few moments. Then I turned to my sister and I said, okay, either it's going to be some random person who's opening the door and we're not going to have a clue what's going on, and actually, who knows what can happen in Israel on Purim, so maybe this isn't the best idea. Besides, Reb Kupperman's probably not home anyway. It's Purim, he's probably with his family. And we started to despair. But a second later, the door opened, and there stood Reb Kupperman. And I just remember feeling completely overwhelmed and thrilled to see him. I hadn't seen him in a while, in over 10 years at that point. And the fact that he was standing there and he was home on Purim afternoon was very exciting. He invited us in. We reminisced about the past, about being in Mechala. I introduced my youngest sister and my three-year-old daughter to him as future Talmidot in Mechala. And he started talking about students and former students, his family, of whom he has pictures hung very prominently around his apartment, all of his children in the hallway, and his grandchildren's wedding pictures lined up in his living room, and a huge picture with a huge family, which he already told me very proudly that a few more great-grandchildren had been born since that picture had gone up. And as I was talking to him there in his living room, feeling, you know, such joy, such a connection, and I really felt like Reb Kupperman's home was a part of Mechala for me. All the memories came back, trekking up the hill and the staircases of Bayit Vegan. We would come to his house and the Rabbanit would open the door and she would start fussing over us whether our knapsacks were too heavy and if we had enough water. And we would sit around his table and learn Masha Chachma in his home. And to me, Reb Kupperman's home was a part of my Mechala experience. And that was extraordinary. And I think that was part of what made so many people really have a Kesher Miuchad im Reb Kupperman. He was so invested in Mechala. In each and every one of his Talmidos, he gave everyone the feeling that he's available and interested in any questions that you might have. No matter how long it took, he would sit down with you, even though it was probably many of them were questions that he's heard many times before. But you would come over to him with a question, his face would light up, and he would be very excited to learn with you. And learning with Reb Kupperman was really an adventure. He would often say, Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam shel Torah omed, al ha'halacha, al ha'machshava, v'al ha'parshanut, the symphonia shel shlosha. Right, and Reb Kupperman was very musical, so anything that had to do with the symphony was exciting. And indeed, he incorporated all three, halacha, machshava, and parshanut, into the way that he taught in Mechala. This week's parsha begins, Ve'ela ha-mishpatim asher tasim lefnehem. I remember learning this parsha with Reb Kupperman in his Arena B'chaye class. Rashi on this pasuk says, Kol makom sh'nemar eleh pasal al harishonim, ve'ele mosif al harishonim. Ma harishonim misinai, af elu misinai. Rashi quotes Chazal to tell us that ve'ele hamishpatim indicates that this parsha is connected to the one before it, which is the parsha of the Aseret HaDibros, that all the halachos and the details in this parsha were commanded to Moshe by Hashem on Har Sinai. Rabbeinu Bachaye adds here that the entire Torah and all of its building blocks, some of them in the form of Torah Shebichsav, some of them in the form of Torah Shebaal Peh, were taught to Moshe at Har Sinai and handed down through the Masorah. Now, Rav Kupperman would say that Rashi used the method of Pshuto Shel Mikra, but most of all, Rashi wanted to teach Rashi. Right? Rashi had certain views, hashkafos, values, that he wanted to give over in his parish, that he thought were crucial to living a Torah life, and he used the method of Pshuto Shel Mikra and Agada HaMiyashevet Divrei HaMikra to achieve that goal. So here, Rashi wanted to pause for a moment before we go through the laws in Sefer Mishpatim to remind us the root of these laws and the interpretation, that the laws and their details and the interpretations were all taught to Moshe and Har Sinai. So Ma Kashel Rashi, he might have been bothered by the presence of the Vav at the beginning of the Parsha, but most of all, he wanted to teach us something. And I think the same could be said about Rav Kupperman. Rav Kupperman had values, hashkafos, halachos, Torah knowledge that he wanted to impart, and he did so through teaching Torah, through the text, through the Mefarshim, with a sense of humor and true concern and consideration for each one of his talmidos. Rashi continues, Asher tasim lefnehem, Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu leMoshe, lo tala al dadcha lomar, Eshne lahem haperek v'hahalacha beiz o gimel pa'amim ad shetehe stura b'pihem kimishnata ve'eini matriach atzmi lahavinam ta'amei hadavar u'peirusho lekach ne'amar asher tasim lefnehem. Rashi says, in order to teach Torah and ensure the continuity of the Mesorah, Moshe will have to put in an effort to teach Bnei Yisrael the halachos and the Torah. He can't just say, I'll tell it to them once or twice, or I'll make them memorize it, and then my work is done. Rather, he has to make it clear and accessible to Bnei Yisrael in a way that they can internalize and understand the mitzvahs in the Torah. Rav Kupperman clearly put a lot of thought into the way that he taught. He didn't just want us to memorize what he was saying or to accept it at face value so that we could recite it back, but he would engage with the texts, encourage us to keep learning, to ask questions, to look for answers, to feel a connection to our Mesorah, to Torah Misinai. Especially as mothers, to feel that we are a link in the chain of the Mesorah, to feel that we are an integral part of something greater. Mi heim ohavei seichel, Rav Kupperman would say, hatamidot sheba mechlala. I think that Rav Kupperman worked very hard to make mechlala into not just an excellent mosad, an institution, but also into a musag, a concept, a worldview. One man who influenced so many people, made such a tremendous contribution to women's learning and education, to chinuch habanot. Rav Kupperman taught and inspired two, even three generations of women, of mothers and teachers, who along with Rav Kupperman's family are all a part of his incredible legacy. Rav Kupperman would often say that Torah is netzach, forever. Dor holech v'dor ba v'hamitzvah li'olam omedet. Times change, and generations come and go, but the Torah and the mitzvos remain forever. Dor holech v'dor ba v'hashpa'ah shel harav Kupperman li'olam omedet. He's a fro barach. I'm going to shake a second.
So just for the sake of reliving old times, I wanted to start with the idea that it all began with that one girl who had a question, who was thinking, and who said, Hamore, tzarich ladat she'anachnu chunachnu ladat she'mutar lanu lachlok al chazal. And as Professor Rosenzweig said, that was the beginning of the beginning, or the end of the beginning. That was what began the process and the journey, and I would say the empire that is today Rev Cooperman's institution and his vision and his family. He often told us that he found it somewhat amusing, in his typical slightly humorous style, that he had to come all the way from Catholic Ireland to the Holy Eretz Yisrael to teach Chinuch Dati, that Talmud Torah must be predicated on the ideas of Torah Min HaShemayim and Emunat Chachamim. Those were non-negotiables. And I think that in many ways he did. And that is what I would like to speak about for a few minutes, is not simply the effect that he had on creating an institution which, as you can see by looking around you, has affected hundreds, if not thousands, of not just women, but families and people across the Jewish world. It wasn't just his Torah and his institution, but who he was as a person. And I think that we've maybe heard little bits and pieces from the professors and faculty who I'm so honored to be following. But I think that what I found was so special was the fact that he believed that TQ, the Torah quotient in your life, must be a combination of LT over LT. You have to have living Torah over learning Torah. You can't have one by itself, nor can you have the other by itself. They must come together. And so that kind of idea of this combination is what I think made the piercing insights and brilliant mind that he had all the more unique, was because they came along with who he was as a person. And so I just have a couple quick stories to share, and then a Torah thought from his own words. All of the speakers who spoke before were lucky enough to study at Mechila at a time when Rav Kupperman had an able partner at his side. The Rabbanit Kupperman was an integral part of what he built and created, and he was forever acknowledging that and reminding us that what happened and what we were able to benefit from was, if not more than half, definitely in part due to what she added to what he did. I, however, was there at a time when the Rabbanit had already been failing for multiple years. She was suffering from Alzheimer's, and unfortunately, a couple years before I arrived on campus in fall 2012, she was no longer able to live in the apartment with Rav Kupperman that they had lived in for so many years there in Rehov HaPiskah, and she moved down to the campus of Mechila and moved in with her son and daughter-in-law. The fascinating thing was that I can't compare it to anything that came before because I wasn't there before, but definitely that year I was able to see not simply a beautiful husband and wife relationship, but a true partnership, one where they supported each other. And I will slightly ashamedly, maybe because I was fine, but mostly unabashedly because it gave me so much, would often sneak up to the top floor of Mechila, right, pink the Cheder Ochel, where the junior of Kupperman and his wife lived, and where Rabbanit Tzipora Kupperman at the time lived, and wait, because at lunchtime every day, Rav Kupperman would go and pick up his Rabbanit, and they would go for a walk. They would walk up and down the stone pathways of the campus that they built together. And you could see how much had been built between them as they built something that went beyond them together. And I think that window into his immediate family tells us a little bit of something about how he saw the family that was his students, the family made up of the Bogrot HaMichlala and the Banot HaMichlala. And that brings me to the next piece, which is from something that I found in my notes from the famous Chug HaMashiach Chachma that I was also privileged to be a part of during my year in Mechila. And I was flipping through my notebook over the last month, and I found this particular set of notes. It's the Meshech Chachma in Parshat Vayechi, which is in and of itself, I think, meaningful. And what we learned in class that day was that there's a machloket chazal, as per usual, there's a machloket. And the machloket chazal questions what would have been the ultimate shevach for Yaakov after he died. There were two options. During his lifetime, the famine in Egypt stopped, and there was plenty of food for everyone. But what would be the optimal situation after his passing? That the famine should continue to be not present, right? That there should still continue to be enough food in his schus, or that all of Egypt should strongly feel his loss through the return of the famine. What would have been the strongest praise of Yaakov and his life and his kedusha? And understandably, it's a machloket, because it's not clear, right? It could be one or it could be other. And to that I say, I have me doubts. Because I think that it's a combination, like so many other things. And like a child feels, I think, I know I myself have felt, and I would venture to say others of you in the audience tonight have also felt, that over the last month or so, there's been feelings of both. On one hand, there's a significant loss. And on the other hand, you recognize just how much has been given and contributed to our worlds and to the greater worlds by this one human being. And I think that this also ties to another thing he said. It's a night full of quotes, because Rav Kupferman had so many wonderful ones. He would say that when people discuss women's education, which was very clearly a passion of his, there are two Kiyulu statements. And the next speaker is going to address that. But I think that's something, A, for everyone to look forward to. But I think that while you're sitting on the edges of your seats, for those of you who don't know, that is, again, something that he so strongly believed in, is that there's a kesher that goes beyond the text and beyond the intellect, of which he was such a master, and that goes into the personal, that goes into the frame in which the information is presented. And one of the things that I am lucky enough to have on record from one of my last classes with him was that year we were coming up on the 50th anniversary of the Mechola. And he proudly said that during the first 25 years of Mechola, all of his students were like his daughters. And during the second 25 years, all of the students were like his granddaughters. And I think that as Bezrat Hashem, the institution of Mechola continues to live on with his vision, I would venture to say that both the continued bevy of beautiful students who move their way through the ranks of Mechola, as well as the countless families and friends that they influence because of the experiences they had there, will be the great-grandchildren and great-great-great-grandchildren ad netzach of Rav Kupferman. And the last idea that I want to share before I close is the fact that he was also a multifaceted person, which for somebody like me meant a lot. And for me, it's important to be able to respect someone that I learn from, not simply for the brilliance and the intellect that they have to share with me, but for who they are as a person. Most people, Baruch Hashem, that I've had the honor of learning from are wonderful people. But Rav Kupferman took wonderful to like an entirely new level. And I think that, as Professor Rosenzweig said, he was a man with a mission, a man with a brilliant mind. But what made him special was the soul that twinkled through his eyes and crept its way out through that big warm smile and under those bushy white eyebrows when I was there, and that just kind of spread itself in like a little halo as he walked through the campus and into a room, or sat at the head of the table and asked for that evening's Kol Isha. And I think that it's that soul, that you know, told everyone there's only two things you need to find and you'll be set, a BA and a BT. Find a Ben Adam and a Ben Torah and you're good to go, right? That there needs to be that dual piece, someone who can appreciate the Emunat Chachamim and the Torah Min HaShemayim, but also be a mensch. And he was like an ubermensch, not to bring in philosophy, but in terms of his humor, his musicality, his connection, not simply to the text itself, but to its meaning beyond the individual moments. And most of all, I think the love that he had for every single person who crossed his path, no matter the reason and no matter their background. And that's really what I wanted to share most of all tonight, was the fact that I think, as I said earlier, just by looking around here tonight, we see that the his zechut still lives on, right? Like the famine is not present to the same extent because there is so much more Torah in the world because of him. But at the same time, I personally at least feel that there's the famine has definitely returned, because I know for myself, there's a call that I wished I would have had the opportunity to make, and that I never did. And so all I wanted to say was that if I could, I would make that call now. And we'll see if this works. And I would say thank you. So that's the end. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, everybody. So as the last speaker, obviously, there's a little bit of both people not wanting to go on for too long, especially since I hope that people aren't so tired out by the end that they don't stay for the learning, which is going to be amazing. The fact that I'm last is actually somewhat of a good thing, and it's the lens that I'm going to focus what I say through, because I'm somewhat of a representative of the last year of Michlala and Machal, specifically for me, in which he was constantly, not so much constantly, because there were times when he was ill and he wasn't able to be there, but basically consistently present. And now the Shulchan is a great time to reflect on that. So just basically as a little bit of background, I participated by the time that we hit Michlala. He'd stopped teaching Bereshis, and there was Rabbeinu Bache, which was mandatory for the entire Machal. There was Sfarno and Meshech Chachma, which were both classes within the regular schedule. And then there was, in his home, there was the Chug of Kedushat Pshuto Shel Mikra. And I remember the first day of the Chug, I had already decided, I came to Michlala, I did not expect Rav Kuperman to have an impact on me at all. I didn't even know if he was still active. I knew my mother had told me about him back when she went there many years ago, and she did not, I don't think she had any idea whether he was still active. And I came and I was thrilled to hear he was, but I knew I was never going to join his chug. I was never going to do it. It was far too late at night. It was far too long and steep a walk, up far too many stairs. It's the sort of experience that my seminary year would probably be fine without. But then my friends schlepped me along the first week, and then I experienced it for that first week, and I realized that even if my seminary year would be okay without this chug, it probably would have been. But it was incredible, and at risk of sounding corny, life-changing with it. And every week we would sit in his home, as many people have described. It really felt like another class, like his home, like with all of his pictures. It almost felt like another classroom of Michala, studying each time a different section from that parsha. Sometimes we'd continue on to the next week because we almost never finished our section from that week of Tushat Pshuto Shel Mikra. And it's an incredible feeling to study a sefer with the person who wrote it and who's able to give insight into how he wanted to convey his thoughts. And it's really a kind of a humbling thought that our chug was the last group of people to experience, like out of, over many, many years, as all of the professors and fellow students have mentioned so far, of this chug, we were the last year to merit to be part of such a thing, and it's also, we have to think, an amazing opportunity that we were able to be blessed with. So, Rav Kuperman was known for his many witty quotes, which I saved in the form of the wall of my dorm room, which was filled with many quotes, most of which were from Rav Kuperman. So I picked four different aspects of Rav Kuperman's impact on me personally, I headed each one with a quote that I felt was apropos. So I'm going to start with his style of learning. And for that, I'll use the quote Rashi wrote with golden ink, which should sound very familiar. And these are quotes that he used over many years, whether in the Israeli program or the American program. I've heard the Hebrew equivalents of all of them at some point. And so to start with the learning, Rashi wrote with golden ink, which is something he said many, many times. So I'm not the expert in the way that he learned, just in how I received it, but the way that he encouraged, obviously, as many people were saying, about his emphasis on, obviously, Chazal, and what's it called, his rejection of the idea that many people in his time had come up with, which is that you could challenge Chazal. This was something, his method was, Pshuto Shel Mikra, he referred to Rashi's idea as, like, melding the Pshat and the Drash. And if, what's it called, we gained an understanding of his intense appreciation of both of them, how he integrated the two, and then we gained knowledge about different mefarshim, whether of Meir Simcha Midvinska, who wrote the Meshech Chachma, or Rav Yisfarno, many other parshanim he discussed, and the learning process could integrate things from pieces of Gemara to anecdotes about learning with Nechama Leibovitz, references to Rishonim and Achronim, references to his extensive general knowledge, and almost invariably a description of the greatness of Rashi or of Rambam as Hanesher HaGadol. And the integration of so many approaches not only taught us, you know, each different one in particular, but also about the general learning process. So then we're going to get to the quote which I kind of stole from Racheli, which is, I want to talk about his teaching style, and one quote which he said every so often was, the difference between boys learning and girls learning is that with boys you say ata, and with girls you say at, with the implication being there isn't any, and he had a, and he was, he was very rigorous and demanding of our learning in the way that he would have been in any setting, and what's it called, and honestly, at his age, he was, what's it called, when we were there, he was 85, 86 years old. At that sort of an age, especially after the really long, fruitful life he'd already lived, it's very, very justifiable to sit back and retire and just see what, and not be as active as he was. He taught four different classes, just in Macha, as well as, I believe, some classes in the general Michala. And he spent an unbelievable amount of time with us, making sure, teaching us, making sure we learn. He took different classes on different Sfarim, every class was aiming to teach us something new, a new way of looking at an inyan, a new yesod of halacha or shkafa, or even just some new factoid we never knew about the history of Parshanut. And he would call on that kolisha to read, and he would help out as it would go on. And especially in the chug, he would have a special focus on not only teaching us how to learn, like showing his thought process as he wrote the sefer and what he would include at each point, but also on teaching us little things like handy phrases in colloquial Hebrew that he thought it would be useful for us to know, or just different acronyms that he wanted to make sure that we knew that we would encounter in other learning. And, of course, classes could be derailed, and I apologize for being the one who often did it by just asking a question which would bring everybody into some sort of an argument that generally meant that we did not finish what we were meant to be learning, but instead taught us a lot as he tried to guide us through whatever we were learning. So then to his hashkafa, and here the definitive quote is, I don't teach hashkafa, I teach Torah, and Torah builds hashkafa. And what his hashkafa was actually one of the things that struck me the most, and because many of the things in his lessons, or sometimes even just the conversations or like little, you know, moments that we had in class, before class, after class, and they gave us insight into his unique hashkafa. And as his quote pointed out, it was rarely deliberate. Sometimes it would just be different things that he would say that just about his life, but often it was simply whether he would like bring out a specific lesson to teach that day that had to do with the Torah, that had to do with, at its center, an idea of hashkafa, or there would be, and that would be a central core part of the class. He might bring an entire longer Beinu Bachye solely for the tidbit of Musar at the end. And he was a strong person also who, and that strength is really important. Like, he was driven by his principles. He wouldn't let anybody get in his way. He had his very own unique set of hashkafos that didn't fit into any box, which, like Racheli said, something I could also very much appreciated. And he was very steadfast in his hashkafos, and he built, as many people have said, he built an entire educational powerhouse because he wanted to uphold a part of hashkafa that he felt was absolutely necessary. He took an idea and something that really irked him even and turned it into a major institution of learning that gave so much to so many. And so we learned so much from his personal example of clarity of hashkafa and firmness of conviction. And then here's the final part, which I could not pick between different quotations, such as Sunday is Shabbos Sheni Shel Galios, or men tend to refer to the Gemara as female, perhaps it's because they love it so much, and every woman in Vayavagan is either Ba'agala or Bizman Kariv, which basically what many, many people here have already discussed, and I can just add a little bit more of just his sense of humor and his, like, you know, friendliness to us constantly. He's always, if you were to bump, whether you're, like, whether in the classroom or walking into him in the hall or anything like that, he would all, or eating in the cheder ocha, we would often see him eating there. And he would always be very kind, very sweet. If something looked like something was wrong, he would always come and ask if he could help out. And he always joked about our chug as being the Weight Watchers chabura. And he always tried to convince us to take a bus or a cab up because it was such a, you know, crazy walk. But we did it anyway. And he was always concerned, you know, how we were doing during the various rainstorms and snowstorms and sandstorms that we would walk through to get up there every Wednesday night. And just the feeling, and you're going to make a t-shirt for our chavura, and you're going to give him one, and we never did that, which is a shame. But all these different things, like he really felt like somebody, yes, a kesher miyuchad, something, a connection that we really had with him. And losing him didn't just mean losing a huge Talmud Chacham, but also just an amazing person. So I've mostly spoken from the perspective of somebody who, as I did, spent a lot of time in his various classes and in big classes, small classes, but even the people who did not experience all of these classes still felt some sort of a connection. And even if it's just, you know, in the same way that he would, like, speak to the girls and, like, in the hallway or in the cheder ochel, or I remember many people were very affected when he spoke on Yom Yerushalayim about his experiences back in after Hakamat Medina and different things like that. It was just, and he was like sort of bridging a gap between generations, or even just being in Michala and hearing from the teachers constantly, and just even feeling in the air that how fortunate we were to be in the presence of a really great man. And as hard as it is to realize that he's no longer with us, it's been, for us, it's been less than a year since our last chug, and up until very recently, we were always still, like, either joking or talking about if we could call him and ask a question when we would learn his sefer or something like that, and it's hard to realize that we won't be able to do that. But part of the feeling is bittersweet that we still got that opportunity to have that last year to be able to gain so much from him. He's a forever.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us, and especially to our speakers. We put together, actually, I should say, first I want to thank Alana Kamenetsky, Esty Zakharowicz, and Adina Washlag for all their hard work and putting this shloshim together. They really helped make this program really meaningful and special, and it will definitely be a zechus for his neshama and a nechama for the family. They also put together, I'm sure some of you know and have contributed to different, we have put together some reflections and memories. So please make sure to take on your way out. We have many more of these. And also we'll continue learning in the back. So thank you very much, everyone, for coming, and we only shared some fun.
I think Connie might want to explain.